Welcome to
the Plant-Based Podcast.
In case you didn't know already, plants are amazing. You can
eat them,
wear them,
drink them,
nourish your skin with them,
grow them,
love them,
and be inspired by them. So why not join us on the Plant-Based Podcast as we speak to the movers, shakers, and growers in this amazing plant world.
This episode of the Plant-Based Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Natural Grower. Launched in 2019, their award-winning liquid fertilizer and soil conditioner is made entirely from maize. Visit naturalgrower.co.uk to nurture your soil and boost your plants and veg. Enter PBP15 for a 15% discount as a PBP subscriber.
So today's guest on the podcast is a wildlife hero. He's been voted Conservation Hero of the Year, awarded the top honour at the Wild Screen Panda Awards, Honorary Doctor of Science by the University of Southampton, and has been appointed a CBE for services to wildlife and nature conservation. And that's not to mention Spring and Autumn Watch, and never forgetting the awesome Really Wild show as well. So if you haven't already guessed who today guest is, it is of course Chris Packham and Sid and Nancy the dogs. Let's not forget them.
We won't probably be able to forget them. They'll intrude at some point with a vocalisation, a little repertoire of vocalisations which they put into practice whenever you don't want to hear it.
They definitely made us feel very welcome, right?
When we were coming, I knew you'd arrived.
We knew about it, but they're absolutely gorgeous. So welcome Sid and Nancy to the podcast as well. And we are sitting outside at Chris's home. It's a really lovely day, isn't it, as well? There's so many insects and butterflies and birds singing all around us. It's absolutely beautiful. So thank you so much for having us.
You're most welcome.
And coming onto the podcast. So usually we start the podcast by asking our guest where it all began. You know, where your love of nature began. Was it as a child or was it later on? Just your whole world is about supporting nature, campaigning for nature and wildlife, and kind of putting that out there and getting everyone involved. So where did it begin for you?
It began in a small suburban garden about 10 miles from here on the edge of Southampton. And my parents say before I could even speak, I was crawling around and picking things up, incarcerating ladybirds in empty matchboxes and tadpoles in jam jars. And when I was a year old, my grandmother bought me some bird books, and I still remember every single painting in those bird books. So even at, I must have had those when I was, you know, between, obviously they're for between one and two, and I was fascinated by life, and I was a faddist as a child. So first of all it was bats, and then it was mice. By the time I was five, it was dinosaurs, of course. Many young kids get into dinosaurs. But at that time it was all about the things that I could find and keep and watch, put on my bedroom windowsill. Eventually I got some tanks and could keep some larger things. Eventually the garden was filled full of enclosures and I had all sorts of other things. I was very fortunate that my parents supported my interest. They were very keen on, you know, me reading, so they bought me as many books as they could, and they took me to the library every weekend, and so I was able to sort of fuel that interest. There wasn't obviously, this is early 60s, there wasn't the resources that we have now accessible to everyone online and with TV programmes, etc. So, and they took me out, and that was the main thing. I mean, I enjoyed exploring the garden, and then they would bring me here to the New Forest where we're sat today pretty much every weekend. Otherwise, the moaning and nagging would get too much for them. I was a very keen visitor to a zoo on Southampton Common where I could see exotic animals, and in those days, the way that they were kept was not with the degrees of, you know, husbandry that we have now, so you could sort of reach out and stroke them through the cages. Mm. You know, and I remember touching a jaguar and
Whoa.
Getting pecked by a penguin and licked by a giraffe and all of those things, and these are all very formative moments for me. That contact with animals, I think, was, you know, really important when it came to igniting that spark of curiosity which still burns today.
You know, I know our listeners will laugh when I say this, but it is almost every single podcast that we record. Our guests will always say something began when they were small. Mm-hmm. Always. I mean, you know, the podcast is all about nature, wildlife, plants, you know, the plant world, gardening. Even if somebody hasn't spent their whole life working in that industry or it being their hobby, they've always come back to it later. But that spark was always from being very young, wasn't it?
I think that's not uncommon, though, because, you know, if you think about biophilia, then, you know, there is a sort of an idea that there's a genetical basis for our love of other life, our need to contact other life, to understand it both positively and negatively, because it wasn't too long ago that we would have needed to be able to understand the natural around us in order to survive on a daily basis. Mm. We would have needed to find food and avoid being food.
Yeah.
So that young people are drawn to the diversity, the richness, all the sounds, the colours, the, you know, the textures of other life, I don't think is surprising. What's disappointing is, of course, that they don't all stick with it.
Yeah.
And they give up at some point. But we do know, again, you know, if kids get into wildlife when they're young, they obviously drift off in adolescence, but there's a far greater chance they will return to it if they have had that opportunity to engage in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, I mean, the way I see it is that we are nature. You know, we're on this planet, aren't we? With everything, we're all kind of one. So it just makes sense to me that we have this draw to being.
People are on the way to understand that more than ever as well.
I hope so.
Hopefully.
Long way to go.
Yeah.
Not everyone. I won't mention any politicians.
I think that's probably our greatest problem at the moment is our disconnect from nature. We've forgotten that we are an integral part of the ecology of this planet, a dominant part now, due to our enormous population and our technologies and the impact that they're having. But nevertheless, we're still dependent on, you know, fresh water, clean air, all of the resources that what I call ecosystem services Earth offer us in terms of the wood for fuel or for building, the soil which grows our crops, the seas from which we harvest fish, those of us that eat them. You know, and as a consequence of that, you know, that disconnect is dangerous. And I think that for a long time, there was this idea that, you know, we were the be-all and end-all of everything and everything else was there for us to, you know, throw dominion over and exploit and use and abuse to our heart's content. But we've just been very frankly reminded that, you know, there are aspects of nature, albeit a tiny virus, but a natural part of the world's, you know, living community, which has come out to bite us.
Yeah.
And that's because we've allowed ourselves to be vulnerable because we haven't been treating that environment with the respect that it needs.
No, we haven't.
Yeah. And do you feel there's been enough of a wake-up call?
I'm surprised that, you know, there are still wet markets open in the Far East. We're still not entirely sure, are we, whether this was a virus which crossed, you know, species from different parts of the world and then entered the human. Mm-hmm. If that was the case, then, you know, the transport of live animals around the world for the nefarious trade that is plied there is outrageous. I think that, you know, people wanting to get back to normal is downright stupid. Clearly normal was abnormal. Business was bad business. So I think this should be a fantastic opportunity for us to, you know, stop in our tracks. We've been stopped in our tracks. You know, to rethink what we were doing. Unfortunately, there are too many people who are too unimaginative or lazy, and they just want to, you know, scramble back to where we were.
Yeah. Very true.
Which is really disappointing. But we're going to fight them, so that's okay. You know, we know that we need the Green New Deal in some way, shape or form. And we are, you know, very keen to instigate, you know, processes, new economies, new ways of living and working and, you know, being educated, which are more compatible with protecting the environment rather than making ourselves terribly vulnerable to it.
Okay. Well, first, we're going to take it back a few years. We want to talk about your early media career, because obviously we will have seen you, first of all, on The Really Wild Show when we were, you know, coming home from school.
Made
every
me feel
day.
Really old.
Yeah, sorry. But what did you study at school before then, and how did your journey into media happen?
Entirely accidentally. We weren't encouraged to watch too much TV as a kid. It was Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet, and then, you know, all of those sorts of things. Then I got into the documentaries, so it was Horizon and Chronicle and The Ascent of Man. There were some quite remarkable documentaries made in the 70s and, 60s and early 70s. But I studied, you know, the sciences. I was really keen on art. I still very keen on art, but there was a great sort of rift between my artistic intentions and my scientific intentions, and the latter won over. So I did my science O levels, as they were then, A levels, and then went off and studied zoology at university. It wasn't the easiest time of my life. I wasn't getting on terribly well with the world at that point. And so when I left university, I was sort of, I think, quite well qualified in terms of as an ecologist and zoologist, but I wasn't very compatible with the rest of the world. So I was very fortunate that I happened to bump into someone. I bumped into me, nearly ran me over, a wildlife cameraman, and I ended up working with him for a few years, and he was making some of the early Attenborough series. And so it was only through that, and then I was had started doing my own film camera work. I'd lost a job, I wanted to buy a car, didn't have any money, and I heard about the Really Wild Show and sort of virtually demanded an audition. Not because I really wanted to be on TV, I just wanted some money.
You just really wanted that car.
I wanted to buy a very special car. And as a consequence, you know, I went and did the audition and had no sort of qualms. I'd always sort of bored my family rigid for hours and hours, you know, going on and on with my obsessive interest in natural history. So I wasn't worried about, you know, any limitations when it came to expressing my passion for the natural world. But I did have to work in a team of people, which I hadn't done. I've been trying to hide away from human beings, and also with, obviously, with young people, because we start with a live audience. And my sister's 4 years younger than me, and I didn't spend any time around children. So I wasn't worried about the animals. I wasn't worried about, you know, not being able to talk for hours and hours about, you know, the sex life of tawny owls or something. But working in teams and dealing with young people was quite terrifying.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Like, they usually say don't work with children and animals, wow. You know? I'm so pleased that you wanted that car. Yeah. Because, honestly...
I did buy the car. So at that time, every time I was walking to Steve Bolwell, who was the cameraman's house, I walked past an Aston Martin that was parked on someone's driveway. And I'd never been into cars as a kid at all. It was natural things and art, like I say. Anyway, I loved that car. It was just, there was something about it. It was superbly beautiful. So I decided that I wanted one and became an obsession. And so I started saving modest sums of money in my building society account, but way short of the total. And then I got a commission to write some books. And so I got a contract and allowed me access to a little bit more money, but I still didn't have enough. And this was in the early 80s. And at that point, those old classic cars were accelerating, you know, far greater in value than they were in the speed on the road. Yeah. And every week I was looking in Exchange and Mart, which was the marketplace for them. And the price was going up by, you know, 500, 1,000. And it was going to be out of my reach. And so that was the desperation to buy an old Aston Martin that drove me into the offices of the Really Wild Show.
That's amazing.
To actually demand a job.
I love that you demanded it. Well, we'd never be able to demand an audition.
No, I was quite a sort of demonstrative and, you know, sort of person at that point.
Well, look where that's got you now. You got your Aston Martin and everyone knows you for all of the work that you do for wildlife, which is just absolutely amazing. Now, obviously, the Really Wild Show, when I was younger, I used to watch that and it completely used to captivate me because it was fun as well as educational. And I can always remember seeing, you know, animals and reptiles especially and thinking, wow, like, are they real? You know, like, because it's just incredible. And that ran for years, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I did it. So it started in 85. We recorded the first one in the winter of 1985. And then I think I left in 1990 for a year, and then I went back again for a couple of more years. But the programme itself, by which stage, by the time I'd left, Michaela Strachan had joined, and then she stayed to the end, and it went on all the way through the through the 90s. I think its success was down to the fact that, you know, it was packed full of information. I once did some sort of analysis of it, and there were more facts per minute, considerably more facts per minute than there were in any of Attenborough's documentaries at that time. Nice. Yeah, so it was highly educational, and we were fortunate to have a rolling, innovative team of people who would take quite complex science and find a way of distilling it into a very simple form for young people to understand through demonstrations, or we'd have the live animal, or we'd make a film about something. But when you look back at the content, it was stuff that, these days, I imagine many people, certainly if they were seeking to explain it to an audience of, less than 14-year-olds, would probably shy away from it. But that was our challenge. We wanted them to understand how life worked.
Yeah.
And we'd all sit around and try and come up with some mad ideas using kitchen utensils.
It was
a bit Blue Peter. I remember... We were talking about cuttlefish, and they have these sort of cells in their bodies called chromatophores, organs, which they can expand to fill with fluid of different colours, and therefore they can change their colour.
Okay.
And so in order to demonstrate this, we got a whole load of different coloured parasols, and we put the camera up at the top of the studio looking down, and we had all the young people there with their parasols putting them up and down, and it was flashing in the same
That's
way that a cuttlefish would. So they were really simple things like that.
But so creative.
Yeah.
And it captures young
and
people's like vision.
Need to be memorable for
I think
kids
so.
To take
it,
in
it was
well.
Fast, it was like fun, but it was educational. And I do think children retain a lot of information, don't they? You just absorb it all. So that's
But I have to ask, was there any real hairy moments on the show where things could have gone wrong? Like there was a rhino backstage and it was going to charge everyone? Or...
we always had, for the first few years, we had animals in the studio, and obviously we would take great care if they were animals that were potentially dangerous, so big cats and venomous snakes and crocodiles, alligators, those sorts of things. I remember there was a lady who would bring big cats, and she had some hand-reared animals. And on one occasion, I heard that she'd arrived, and then I was dispatched to the back gate of BBC Bristol to see where it was. And so I went out, and she was in the car park there, and she was meant to be bringing a Jaguar. She happened to be driving a Jaguar. So she put the window down, and I said... Where? And then she went like that, and I looked on the back seat, and there was a Jaguar laid out on the back seat of a Jaguar. So she sort of put its lead on and brought it into the studio. The interesting thing was, when we had animals like that, obviously we were really careful about making sure that we understood not just the species but the individual, and obviously there were restrictions as to how close the young people could get to them and things. Our only catastrophe was on one occasion we wanted to do something about rabbits, and so we built a large turfed area in the studio, onto which we put about 30 rabbits. Well, at that point in time, to be honest, I wasn't a rabbit expert. I knew that they fought, and I knew that they were female dominated, and the females would kill one another and all those sorts of things, but I'd never kept rabbits. And whenever I bumped into a rabbit, it was invariably a wild one that was being eaten by something more interesting. So anyway, the rabbit owners came in, they put the rabbits onto the turfed area, and they did one of two things. They either fought one another incredibly viciously, or they immediately began to mate, distressed the owners. So the young people there were grabbing the rabbits, they were getting scratched, their clothing was damaged. We had more injuries, bites and scratches and torn clothing from the rabbits than we ever did from any alligators, lions, tigers and everything else that we had in the studio.
That sounds like absolute chaos.
It was for a few minutes.
We all really enjoyed the show. So, you've done tons of documentaries and all kinds of filming as well over the year, but more recently, of course, the success of Spring Watch, Autumn Watch and, of course, Winter Watch. That's also really, really captured everyone, hasn't it? I literally couldn't wait to watch Spring Watch, when the series ended, it was like, oh, I can't wait for spring next year, more than usual.
It helped a lot of people engage that wouldn't naturally
absolutely.
Be interested because of the prime time slot.
Yeah.
As well.
And because of how it's done and the live cams and everything. So, that's quite a remarkable series. What's it like filming those
It's tremendously.
Series.
I mean, we all look forward to it. And again, you know, we're very fortunate that the entire team is energised with a determination to make the best programme they possibly can. The vast majority of them have a keen interest in natural history as well as their other technical abilities. And it's always a challenge. And I think that because it's a challenge, everyone has to raise their game. Mm. So everyone works incredibly hard on that series. It's long hours. It can be really difficult. And, you know, and we have a team of people that I don't honestly think you could assemble anywhere else in the world when it comes to their expertise. So, but the key to its success outside of that, I think is because it's about this. It's about everyone's backyard.
Yeah.
And of course we titillate people by showing them some exotic species, but they're still within the bounds of the UK and they are still species which are therefore accessible to people. So if we show people golden eagles and pine martens, they could get on a train, get in their electric car, one hopes, and drive to Scotland and go out and see these animals. But the stars of our show are, you know, everyday creatures which we share our communities with. There are foxes, there are badgers, there are robins, our blue tits, our blackbirds. And I mean, and those are the birds we can hear singing at the moment. Our mission is to get people closer to those animals, and we use our technology, our mini cameras, to stick them in the nest. And also, of course, my mission, underlying mission, goes back to those days of the Really Wild Show. You know, I want to tell people new things about, you know, those species which they think they know well because they're living alongside them. Yeah. And there's a lot of science being done out there. And, you know, if you trawl through, you can find those exciting new stories about things. Yeah. This year was a bit more of a challenge. We were here, of course. So Megan and I were working from the farmhouse. We had just two cameramen and two engineers who were basically sending the satellite signal up. Yolo, Gillian were in there, you know, close to their homes too, due to the government restrictions at the time. So that made it even more challenging. And the rest of the team were scattered around the country doing it from their garages, their home offices, their lounges and their conservatory. So technically, I think that, you know, it was an astonishing achievement, not down to us presenters, but due to the technical team who managed to get it on air.
Get it all happening.
Yeah,
that's a massive achievement. I've got to just say, Michael has a new friend.
Sid. I've really made friends with.
Sid has joined in.
Sid. Hello.
Gorgeous. Oh, sorry.
Before we move on, I just want to ask, with the Spring Watch and the Autumn Watch, are there any particularly memorable and magical moments that you think really captured you guys filming it, but also the audience?
Oh, many, I think. Yeah. And there are always those things that take you by surprise.
Mm.
You know, I can sometimes get up and I'll go out to the woods and we'll go to look at something and I'll know it's there and I'll go at the right time and then I'll see it and that will be rewarding. But The things that are, I think, you know, leave the most indelible tattoo on your memory are those things where you happen to be in the right place at the right time, but you see something you're not expecting.
Mm.
And so I go into every one of our watches knowing that, you know, the technology that we have and the fact that we're watching these things 24 hours a day for 3 weeks, that's an enormous amount of time looking at just one thing. You can't do that as an individual naturalist. You can't, firstly, get that close to the animals because it would be obtrusive. And then you can't stay awake for that long. So, and I know that I'm going to see something which, you know, I wouldn't see in a lifetime of looking. So, you know, we watched birds dreaming on the nest. I think there's a sort of romantic side. That's always, you know, I found that amazing. We've seen adders climbing up and taking young birds from the nest when we thought that they were terrestrial predators, principally, you know, feeding on small mammals. And here they were, you know, 2-3 metres up into bushes and trees feeding on young birds.
Yeah,
not once, but repeatedly. So our cameras revealed a part of the ecology of a relatively, you know, common, sadly, you know, declining, but common animal that we thought we knew well.
Yeah. So you're not just putting out there all of this information and teaching, you know, us as the viewers, but you're also learning loads of stuff yourself doing it as well.
Yeah, and of course it encourages me to read a lot more about those things, which under normal circumstances, you know, I would be reading about, you know, Vermeer or the First World War or something. And so, you know, because it's so, that's my indulgence, you know, a luxury. Yeah, just all get away from the scientific journals and actually read something, you know, about something completely different.
Yeah.
But during that period, you know, I focused my research, you know, very intently on those things that we're looking at. So that it is a period of sort of constant catching up, as it were. Yeah. And I'm not sure that I would summon the discipline to do that, you know, three times a year as it is now with Spring Watch, Autumn Watch, and Winter Watch.
Yeah.
I'd be reading about Rothko rather than those blue tits that have just been, you know, the study that's just been written up in Czechoslovakia, which is fascinating. You know.
But you have to take a break. You do have to take a break.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think it's really important that we're on top of our game. It was great working with Megan this year. She graduated more recently than I did. She's my stepdaughter, who's 25. And she's got a good nose for those sorts of stories. We've just been writing a book and, you know, we sort of thought, well, OK, are we going to divvy this up then? And I said, well, look, you do all the science bits, those little nuggets, and cultural things as well. And she's got a good nose for finding those things. And so she's done 27 of those throughout the course of the book and other stuff as well. But, you know, she sat there long, you know, sat in silence typing on our laptops. And then she said, did you know? And it was like, no, I didn't. God, it's amazing.
I love that.
So, yes, and that's what it's like being involved in the programme as well. Because someone would just say, you know, they'll send you something. You think, wow, that's unbelievable. I didn't know that.
That's fascinating. We are. Always. Every day is a school day, you know.
This episode of the Plant-Based Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Natural Grower. Visit naturalgrower.co.uk to nurture your soil and boost your plants and veg.
We did touch on this a little bit earlier on when we first introduced the podcast, and that was how perhaps people's ideas and perceptions and connection to nature has changed during the pandemic. And I know we mentioned it a little bit before, but I think it would be good if we could just look at that a little bit deeper. I mean, you know, it's been amazing to see how many people have got out in their gardens, you know, have gone out for walks in woodlands. I mean, I've seen people who've said, oh, we went for a bike ride, you know, around the countryside. We didn't even know this was here, and it's just behind their house, you know.
Yeah.
And I would desperately love that to continue, but will it continue? And we're at this point now where we need to try and keep enforcing, you know, all of this kind of information. Like, this is the moment, do you know, to keep people interested and engaged in nature. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, very definitely. I think some of them won't require any convincing at all. Mm-hmm. I think people are easily caught up in the old ways, and necessarily, I mean, a lot of people, you know, haven't been working, and they need to work. And one of the reasons why I think they weren't connecting with nature is because, you know, our modern lives, you know, our working time is crowded. Mm-hmm. We travel to work. You know, we live in a very different way than even you go back sort of 20 years. You know, I get about 200 emails a day.
Yeah.
I never used to get 200 letters a day.
Yes. You know? I know.
So, so the intensity of work has increased. And I think you're absolutely right. I think when it stopped, people, rather than walk past and tread over all of those things which were in their communities, they had the time to... They'd always seen them, probably, but they never looked at them. Or they'd always heard them but never listened to them. And this was their opportunity to do that. And I think for many of them, they realised that almost instantaneously it enhanced the quality of their life.
Yeah.
It provided them with some essential respite from a period of horrendous confusion, fear and stress. And I think if they recognise that their mental health was improved by that, then they will know, even if they don't use it consistently, they will know they can go back to it when it's required. So I think, yes, for me, the most heartening thing, because you've got to find something good in the bad, and the lockdown and coronavirus has been bad, but the good in it was every morning just going through my social media feeds and seeing people who, you know, were wowed by the most everyday species or everyday natural events. You know, they were so genuinely excited. It was completely uplifting to see effectively you know, a new part of our society opening its eyes to the wonder of wildlife and the natural world.
Yeah.
And in a calculating way, I'm rubbing my hands with glee because I'm thinking at some stage in the very near future, I'm going to be going to these people and saying, well, you know that thing you fell in love with? Well, actually, it's in trouble. It's in critical decline. It's under pressure. You know, will you help us, the conservationists, look after it? And I think the uptake will be far greater.
Yeah.
I'm running an e-action at the moment with a couple of other agencies, and when we started, we imagined that we would get a modest uptake. It's just flown. Yeah. It's just flown.
And has that increased because of the lockdown?
I think so. Mm. I mean, it's going to be difficult to quantify those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But typically, when we ask people to partake in the actions that we're currently asking, it takes, you know, a lot longer to get to the point that we are at this point in time.
Mm.
And all of our every time we set a target, it's broken almost instantaneously. So I think that there are a lot of people who have maybe, you know, opened their ears to those goldfinches which are chattering
lovely,
away over there. And because they've connected with goldfinches, they realise that there's a problem when it comes to raptor persecution. Different bird, different part of the world, not part of their life, but their value, for you know, understanding of the value of nature has grown to a point where they know we need to look after it better. And that doesn't mean, you know, killing it illegally. So maybe those are the people that are signing that action. But, you know, maybe there are people that have never seen the hen harriers and the golden eagles and the goshawks that are being illegally killed. Maybe they've done it because they've fallen in love with their goldfinches on their feeders.
Yeah, you know? That's very true.
That's amazing.
It's the things close to home, isn't it, sometimes? Yeah. I've seen lots of...
an opportunity here.
We do. Yeah. I've seen lots of people take up some very old allotment plots on my site where, you know, they'd been left like that for ages and they've been down there with the children gardening and everything, and it's been just so lovely to see them enjoying it, you know. So long may that continue.
So before we talk about some of your different projects you're involved in, tell us briefly about the charities that you're either president or vice president of.
A range of different things, really. I try to do what I can to support them. Obviously, these days, you know, social media means that I can help them with all of their campaigns, fundraising, awareness, and all of those sorts of things. So I work with a great number. Obviously, the RSPB, who I'm working with at the moment on this e-action, and then Bat Conservation Trust. To be honest with you, I don't necessarily have to have those sort of direct affiliations, you know, vice president, president, patron, all those sorts of things. There are so many small charities that are doing great things that, you know, they are amongst that 200 emails that come in every day, and I'll do what I can to help. And I think that, you know, that's my duty. If I have a platform to communicate and they've got some good ideas, then sharing those good ideas is a good idea. So I'll do that. I also do quite a lot of my own things now. Not all of the charities that I work with have quite the determination and sort of, what should we say, guts and gusto. They've lost a little bit of their campaigning edge, I think. So I will take on board that. And I still continue to work with them. It's not a point of conflict. It's mainly sort of mild dissatisfaction from my point of view. I want them to be doing more. Well, I used to nag them, and I didn't make much progress. And you know, in the end, I just sort of thought, well, do it yourself then.
Yeah. Sometimes that's the only way.
So we've, you know, started a few years ago now. I'd been trying to get people to take some interest in the fact that our migrant birds were being slaughtered in the Mediterranean, on Malta and Cyprus and so on and so forth. They weren't particularly keen to get involved, so we just went out there and started making films ourselves. We got the press interested. We led to some changes in legislation in Malta and to some changes in practice in Cyprus. So it was, you know, I'm not saying the issues have been solved, unfortunately they haven't, but we certainly made some progress, and that was heartening. And I think, again, that empowered myself and the people that I work with to think, do you know what, if we can do that overseas, what can we do here? And then there were gaps in how conservation and environmental care was being run out in the UK, and we've identified a couple of those gaps, and we're doing our best to fill them so that we've got a broader, you know, sort of front when it comes to addressing all of the issues. And then lastly, of course, some of those agencies politically don't have the independence to be able to take some of the fights that I can take as an individual. So recently I led an action against the UK government over HS2.
Yeah.
Now, I was able to do that because of a particular law which limits, caps, if you like, how much money I could lose if I lost the case. If a charity or any other sort of body had taken it, there would have been no limit. Mm-hmm. So you've got to understand that, you know, they can't risk that, and I respect that. You know, we can't lose through sort of bankruptcy. Yeah. One of our principal environmental NGOs, but as a citizen of the UK, I was able to take that action, safe that knowing that I wouldn't be bankrupted if I lost.
Right.
And that's, I think, a very important piece of legislation, because we should all, as individuals, have the right to take those sorts of actions. And that's a piece of European legislation, I should add.
Interesting.
So it will be interesting
will
to see.
Will that change? Yeah.
Well, let's hope not, because, you know, there are people who are sufficiently, you know, sort of self-empowered to take those actions at the moment, and I think that sometimes it does come down to individuals to question, you know, some decisions made by committee, particularly when those committees have, say, vested interest in another agenda. That is one of the last vestiges of our democracy, and I think we must guard it, you know, very keenly.
I quite agree. And, you know, individually we can all make change, you know, and collectively we can all make change, and it's important to do that. There's two campaigns that I know you're particularly vocal about at the moment, and you've got Wildlife Rebellion going at the moment, and the other one was I watched the live about the hen harriers and the grouse driving, which I knew nothing about until I watched your information on that, which is quite disturbing. So.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we're talking about criminal activity here.
Yeah.
So this is not my opinion. This is, we as conservationists have run out of patience with a tiny faction of the shooting fraternity who are criminals, and their businesses are underpinned by criminal behaviour. And having tried to work in partnership with them, with voluntary agreements, having tried to implement the law, there is a law, but it's very difficult to implement, and failed. When we see the number of these birds being killed and it impacting negatively on their populations and distributions, then I think, you know, our patience has run out.
Yeah.
And therefore we are campaigning far more vociferously now to see reforms in that particular type of shooting, which is driven grouse shooting. You know, I'm not saying that they're the only people that are killing raptors, but they are the people that are undoubtedly doing the most damage.
And sorry, just to explain to our listeners, because I didn't know what grouse driving was until literally just a week ago or so. So if you could perhaps explain what that is, and then why the raptors are being killed.
Okay, well, the raptors eat the grouse,
yeah,
along with a lot of other native predators. And obviously, the type of shooting it is that principally men go out and stand in butts. So they stand in a line, in like a sort of a hide, and then beaters drive the grouse to fly over them, and the mission is to try and shoot as many as possible. But in order to facilitate that type of shooting, you need an enormous number of grouse, because, you know, there are vagaries of weather and where the birds will be out on the moor. But if people are paying up to £14,000 a day to go and shoot like that, you've got to deliver some grouse. So they are intensively farmed. Now, they are a native species. It's not that they're introduced, but the habitat is managed with one species in mind, and that is the red grouse. So it's burned, it's drained, they are in super abundance, so they have to be medicated because of transmission of diseases. And of course, if you've got predators there which eat them, they're impacting directly on your ability to, you know,
make money.
And so on those, not all, we should say as well, there are driven grouse estates where we know through looking at satellite tracking data, because we've got plenty of birds now carrying satellite tracking devices which were incredibly accurate in terms of telling us what the bird's doing, when it's doing it, and where, and so on and so forth. We know that some of those birds spend, you know, a lot of time on certain driven grouse estates, and they never come to harm.
Right.
They fly next door, it's over. So, you know, within that community, there are some criminals, and we want to sort it out. We want, you know, eagles back in England. We want eagles back in Wales.
Yeah,
golden eagles once bred in the New Forest. You know,
yeah.
I'm not saying that they could now, perhaps, but we've got white-tailed eagles being released on the Isle of Wight. And the thought that any of those birds would be, you know, killed illegally is abhorrent. So, yeah, our campaign has grown very rapidly, and in terms of public awareness, as you say, you didn't know a week ago, now you know. So that's exactly what we're achieving. We're doing petitions, we run our constant social media actions, we do our blogs. We had Hen Harrier Day 2 weeks ago when we all got together and had a day of broadcasting. Last night I was speaking to Caroline Lucas about this. I do a 15-minute live interview. And tonight I'm talking to Bob Elliott, who's the director of OneKind, an animal welfare charity in Scotland that has grave concerns about, obviously, the illegal activity, but also the legal activity. Because as well as removing all of those birds from their estates, they kill all of the foxes, all of the stoats, all of the crows, all of the ravens, all of these birds which they can legally kill as well. So the slaughter runs into millions, all so that a limited number of people can go and shoot red grouse. And when you think more widely, and what Caroline was talking about last night, is that in terms of the sort of economic and environmental productivity of these areas, it's not maximised at all. They're inaccessible to most people. We can't go to them. If we do go there, there's nothing there but grouse. So unless you want to shoot them, there's not much else to do. They're having an impact on flooding downstream. Water quality, obviously.
Is this to do with burning the
yes,
peat?
Yes, they burn it and it burns the peat. The reason they do that is to promote the growth of fresh heather shoots, and that's what the grouse feed on.
Right.
So it's part of
the young shoots.
Yes, yeah, that's what they eat, the most nutritious.
But there's an environmental issue there as well,
of course,
isn't there, with burning the peat and
tea? Yeah. It's climate change. We're releasing, carbon, an enormous amount of carbon when it comes to peatlands, back into the atmosphere. So look, it needs reform. My cohort are asking for a ban. The RSPB and others support licensing. There are a number of ideas as to how the reform should take place, but there's no ambiguity about the fact that it should.
Yeah, I quite agree. I just wholeheartedly disagree with the whole thing, legal or illegal. I just don't understand how any person would find any joy in sport.
We're not
that
anti-shooting. I say we. My type of conservationist is not anti-shooting. We are anti-criminal and illegal behaviour.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't and shouldn't we be?
Yeah.
And we're also anti-unsustainable shooting. So, shooting of birds which are in critical decline, over-harvesting other species, introducing perhaps an enormous abundance of non-native birds into the UK. So we know that every year in excess of 50 million ring-necked pheasants and red-legged partridge, both non-native species, are released into the British countryside. By the end of the autumn, 50% of the bird biomass out here, the living weight of birds, is made up of these two non-native species. And they are released solely to be shot. And they have an impact, we believe, on the ecology because of the way that they forage and the things that they kill and eat. Also, of course, things kill and eat them. So it leads to increases in our generalist predators, which can then have an impact on our native species.
Yeah.
So shooting has, for a long time, grown without regulation. And that is the problem. And you know what it's like. It's easier not to give someone something in the first place than it is to take it away later.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
And that's why we have a fight on our hands. And if you contrast the way that people shoot here in the UK with the way that they do in other parts of Europe, it's starkly different.
Okay.
There was a lot more legislation there. There was a lot more regulation. They still enjoy what they call sport and so forth. But as I said, it's hard. Can you imagine if we said we wanted to put the speed limit down from 70 to 50? It would be quite hard for the first couple of years to get people to do it, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because, they're used to driving at 70 on the motorways. And it's a fair comparison, I think. We're asking people to change their minds quite quickly from doing something they've been essentially, getting away with for too long.
Yeah, okay. So where can listeners go to sign for sending a letter to the MP about this? Where can they find out more information?
If you go to wildjustice.org.uk/SOS before next Sunday, then you can enter your postcode and a very polite letter will go to your elected representative wherever you are in the UK.
Okay.
Just asking them to take some interest in this and to ask some pertinent questions within the right branches of our government. As we speak, more than 80,000 people in 2 weeks have signed that. Right. And by the end of the week, we will have 100,000 people having signed that. And that, again, shows that the awareness of this issue and its damage and the way it motivates people, because they're cross about it, angry about it, furious about it, compels them to try and do what they can to stop it.
Yeah.
Outside of that, Wild Justice is a not-for-profit that I run with two other conservationists, Mark Avery and Ruth Tingay, and we have we are exploring a type of sort of conservation that the NGOs weren't using. We're taking legal action, so we're taking legal action at the moment over badgers and again shooting of game birds and game bird licensing in Wales and England and so on and so forth. So we are trying to sort of encourage reform by looking for places where the legislation is being breached or it's not strong enough, and we're trying to strengthen it or have it implemented.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not losing a lot of sleep about that. We're just trying to uphold and implement the law of the
law.
Land.
Yeah. You're only looking at the illegal side of it, so that's completely understandable. Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Now, in our next episode, we're going to be talking with Chris about gardening, biodiversity, how we can attract pollinators into your garden, and we're going to find out if Chris enjoys gardening himself as well.
Oh, I had a great day with Chris, but we had to split it into two because we had such great chats with him. So you'll need to tune in next week for part two of our amazing interview with Chris Packham. It was really, really cool. Do you remember his dog's names?
Sid and Nancy.
Yes!
Yeah, they were so cute as well. It was just the best conversation.
Yeah,
and
really chilled.
We kind of delve a bit more into his garden and plants and that and biodiversity in the next episode.
Engaging, just
yeah,
you just know every word he utters is something worth listening to.
Absolutely,
unlike me.
Yes, you can stop now.
But no, join us next week for the second part of the Chris Packham interview and the final episode of series 3.
Oh.
But don't fear, we will be back, and we're actually on the road next few days recording for series 4.
Yep.
This episode of the Plant-Based Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Natural Grower. Launched in 2019, their award-winning liquid fertilizer and soil conditioner is made entirely from maize. Naturally rich in nitrogen, potash, phosphate, and other trace elements that plants and vegetables love, it is approved by the Soil Association, Vegan Society, and Organic Farmers and Growers. Visit naturalgrower.co.uk to nurture your soil and boost your plants and veg. Enter PBP15 for a 15% discount as a PBP subscriber.
Thanks for listening. You should now be at least 25% more obsessed by plants.
Please follow us on social media. You'll find us by typing in the Plant-Based Podcast.
We also have a fabulous website. Go to theplantbasedpodcast.net.
So tell your friends, leave a review. Why not write a letter to your local MP? Please spread the word about the Plant-Based Podcast.
Oh yes, see you next time, plant friends.
The theme music for the Plant-Based Podcast is an excerpt from the song Grow by Mikey James. And our editing is done by Gareth Patch of Semi Echo.